Hello and a welcome to What Divines Us. I'm Rabbi Abram Goodstein.
I'm Matt Schultz, Reverend Matt Schultz, if you don't mind. And I'm laughing because, Abram, you like put on your podcast voice. We were chatting beforehand and you were laughing boisterously and then you went, hello.
I know, right? I've got like different voices for different occasions.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you should hear like my talking to a sad kid voice.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, oh, are you okay?
Yeah.
Are you going to be okay? Oh, no. Yeah, yeah, so there you go.
Sure. Yeah. Well, good to see you. We were talking also before that I am dressed very disheveledly, and I'm just slumming it today because I've had an easy couple of days in terms of I haven't had a lot of meetings or things that I had to be, like, in charge of a group of people or some of those things that are taxing from your social energy level. I've mostly been reading and writing and, you know, making my own plans for future things. And that's, I find that kind of work very relaxing.
Actually,
and nice.
I mean, it's before, Matt, but are you an introvert or an extrovert?
I am very, very much an introvert.
Yeah, me too.
And I have chosen to acquire the skills of extroversion to do some things in the world that I want to do.
You always assume that clergy would be extrovert because we work with and a lot of people.
I think studies show that the majority of clergy are introverts. That might be old. I think I read that like in the previous millennium.
Uh-oh,
it was a long time ago.
That was 24 years ago.
So who knows if it's still the case, but a lot of the ones I know certainly are introverts. We go out there, and actually I saw a pin that you can buy. You put on your lapel, and it's like a little meter, and you can slide the indicator left or right, and it says social energy. And it goes from full to empty, and you can just change it as you go out there your day.
Yeah, and so that's the thing about introverts is that when we have social experiences, it doesn't charge us. Quite the opposite. Yeah. It our battery gets lower and lower from that. But if you're with someone or people who have the opposite, right, mm-hmm. where they go into a crowd of people and they get charged by that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You can see how different those two experiences are.
And it depends probably on the type of social interaction. Like if I'm out at a baseball game in a stadium with a whole bunch of people just yelling like, let's go Mets, that's not going to exhaust me so much. But if I'm at a funeral and I'm talking to people about their grief, like you have to put all of yourself into that moment. Yeah. You can't just be goofing off. So
Right. Yeah, it's exhausting to be with people sometimes. And we have to respect that. And, one of the things about self-care is to recognize that, do I get charged by being with other people?
Yeah.
Or does it take away my energy and to figure out what that looks like to get the energy back? So, introverts, traditionally, by being by ourselves for time, we get that's how we recharge. And so that's really important to recognize.
One thing that surprised me when I then became a parent was – it's not just like I'm tired from that stuff, but now I have less of that social energy to devote to my family,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I need to be sure to save enough.
Yes.
So that when I get home, I still have the social energy to say, how was your day? And really mean it.
Like an emotional wreck while you're home.
Right, to give them the best of myself also. So that takes some intentional.
Some balancing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So today's an easy week for me in those types of things. But how about you? I would think that it's a hard week for you.
Yeah. Dealing with a bit of anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. Matt, which is just, as part of my job as clergy, which I think is unique for rabbis and maybe other sort of, I say, minority groups, is that, people hate us.
I'm
there's
so sorry.
No real reason. There's no good reason why. We've been historically been hated by groups of people, and we continue to be hated groups of people. And so a part of my job, and more of my job than I would like, mm-hmm. is not just reacting to that, but also trying to prevent it from happening in the first place.
Sure.
And so I do a lot of my effort goes towards preventing anti-Semitism.
Now, when I hear anti-Semitism, I guess my brain goes to a few possible kinds of things. Like one of them is spoken or written words.
Yeah.
One of them might be like property damage or vandalism.
Sure.
And then of course the worst would be physical attacks leading to injury or death. What kind of stuff have you been seeing locally?
The way that I describe anti-Semitism to fellow Jews is I say, anytime you're in a situation where someone makes you uncomfortable for being Jewish specifically,
okay,
you are experiencing a kind of anti-Semitism.
Hmm.
Now, I think anti-Semitism really has a spectrum. One side is, I would just say, pure ignorance, right? Yeah. Just sheer lack of knowledge, or no encounter with Jews at all, you know, and no knowledge from that. And the other side is actual hate, right? And so I like to assume it's always ignorance when we experience anti-Semitism.
Right.
That, like, it's not someone that has hate in their heart. Just someone who just has never met someone Jewish before and hasn't encountered what it's like to be Jewish and has some ideas or understandings that they acquired through either through family or friends or whatever. That just isn't true or accurate.
Right.
And as soon as they meet someone who's Jewish, that all goes away. They're like, oh, okay, this is, I understand this now. I have a face where I can picture when I think about Judaism, which means that I'm less inclined to say harmful things. Like that's,
right.
That's usually what the problem is. And then you have the other side of the spectrum where you have whole countries that don't like you, referring to Iran, which maybe we'll get into a little bit later, but probably not now. So there you go. That's kind of the spectrum of it. And so I always joke, and this is kind of a self-deprecating joke. You know, the joke is not really like, you know, if we're experiencing true anti-Semitism, then I didn't work hard enough to prevent it in the first place. Right, that like the goal is that if I'm doing my job right, no one really knows I'm doing it at all.
So I was speaking to a friend of mine recently who is Jewish, and she mentioned that a lot of her public service work comes from an internalized Jewish guilt.
Yes, we're great at
that. And I was like, hey man, I was raised Catholic. I think we share that in common.
Yeah.
It's like, oh no, there's something wrong in the world. It must be my fault.
Yeah. So there's just, I have another story for you. So a lot of times when I encounter someone who I think is Jewish, you know, I'll say something like, are you a Shema reciter? Right. Shema being one of the most important blessings. And the perfect Jewish answer is, well, I am, but I haven't done it in a while. I'm like, perfect. You nailed it.
Yeah. I'm really bad at it, though.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, you'd mentioned we'll get to that in a bit. So, yeah, we have a couple things that we were hoping to talk about before getting into the really important things going on there.
Yeah.
And so one thing that recently took place here in Anchorage that you and I helped to coordinate is the vigil that was a memorial service remembering the lives of people who lost their lives while homeless and outside in Anchorage in the last year. I used a whole lot of words to describe that because it's like it covers a lot of overlapping circles and it leaves a bunch of people out. It's not complete. It's not perfect. But we do know that a lot of people died this year and we wanted to honor them. And there's a population who died while homeless and outdoors, you know, and we did our best to get a full list, but we know it wasn't everyone. And a lot of people died while homeless, but sheltered, and we didn't get them covered and all sorts of other varying overlapping categories in that big Venn diagram. But, you know, as much as we would have liked to get the perfect list of names, we felt it was important at least to give it a try. And if it wasn't perfect, at least we did something.
Yeah, and I feel like our job as clergy is to protect the most vulnerable people of our society. And if we can't protect them, which we don't oftentimes, it's not because we don't want to, it's because we don't have that kind of power sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's really important to highlight, hey, you know, there's harm happening here. And I feel like one of the things that vigil showcase is that the fact that like we've never had so many deaths before,
in
1 year,
people
who are unhoused. It was a new record, and that we were just devastated by that, and we wanted to do something about it. And this was how we chose to do something: is to offer a vigil for the community, so we can all understand that like when these deaths happen, we can't be cold about this, right? Mm-hmm. We can't be. We have to have compassion for even the most vulnerable people in our society, and we're going to offer a vigil to remind Anchorage that that's what we're trying to accomplish.
So not only protecting in hopes that doing this will put the spotlight on this fact and help prevent future deaths, but also just paying the basic respect of remembrance.
Of course,
Other times would be done by maybe their family or their community, but a lot of the people who died in this way have not had those ties for a while. So
yeah,
and not all of them, but many.
And the other thing too is that like is the idea to prevent this from happening again, right? That's another thing the vigil is supposed to showcase, is this idea that like we don't want to do a vigil next year about this.
We don't want to.
But understand that we will if the precedent is there.
Yeah.
And so this is something that we will accomplish, and we will highlight these deaths
because they have never should have happened in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really, I think it's really important to showcase that.
Yeah, agreed. I feel like it accomplished the purpose of showing that respect. I felt good about that, and I feel like the people that attended agreed, and it's still available online. Would we be able to share a link to it
in
how we post this? I think it's on the YouTube page for First United Methodist Church in Anchorage, Alaska. So you can find it that way too.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the description section.
And it was nice that it was a whole bunch of different religious communities coming together. None of us really in charge. I think you were more than most because you were sort of serving as the quarterback, right?
And
directing traffic. But when it came time to the actual day, we all had our piece of the puzzle and we all did our part.
It
felt, not only was it good for the community of Anchorage, but I feel like as clergy, we all felt like we were part of this shared effort. It was really nice.
You mentioned how it's hard to describe. I feel like, Matt, that's where you and I live. We live in a world hard to describe.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that's what clergy do, is they live in this world of non-tangibles. And so, we provide a vigil that was hard to describe to the community, but easy to feel, right? If you were there, you got the feeling of it right away, right? And that's something that we offer to the community, our feelings, feel your feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You sound like Obi-Wan.
Thank you. What a huge compliment. Oh, man.
Reach out with your feelings.
Search your feelings. Yeah. You know it to be true. Yeah.
No, but I agree. And I think there's a weird, we've talked about toxic masculinity on the show before, and there is this weird vibe of trying to project strength by shutting down feelings out there, right? Denying that our feelings even exist. And that's just stupid.
We don't.
And
that so is. Thank
it's
you.
Good to create these moments and these atmospheres where the feelings are honored and taken into account.
And real.
Right.
And enabled. Like, please feel something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
So there we go. I felt like the vigil went really well. And I'm glad we organized it, and we had a good showing. So.
Yeah. And on one hand, I agree with you. I would love to not have one next year, but at this point, we certainly will. I mean, unless there are zero deaths while homeless outside, then I think we'll have one again. But the end goal, no one will die in that manner, and that would be the goal. But presuming that it will happen, it kind of segues in a macabre sort of way into our next topic, which is you brought to Christians for Equality. That's a group that Abram and I are both a part of.
I'm a token Jew, by the way.
We'll talk about that title another time. But I have a story to share about that, but I'm not going to share it on this podcast. Maybe we need like a bloopers reel. But so the other thing you wanted to maybe talk about today is there was an initiative on the ballot for voting here in the Muni about cemeteries.
Yeah, Proposition 7 it was, and it lost by like 8-10 points, lost by enough for it not to be close.
Okay.
That surprised me. You know, in Judaism, cemeteries are super important to us. You know, the thing about if a Jewish community comes to a new town, mm-hmm. right, the first thing they build is not a synagogue. The first thing they build or buy is a cemetery.
Okay.
This comes all the way back to the Book of Genesis, where Abraham buys a cemetery for Sarah. Or buys a grave spot for Sarah, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of tradition around death in Judaism. And so we have deep relationships with cemeteries as well. That's just a thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw Proposition 7 was on our ballot, you know, I told our whole community, hey, like, this is something that we need to support. And everyone was like, yep, that's right.
Can you, in a nutshell, describe what Proposition 7 was hoping to do?
Yeah, so there are cemeteries in Anchorage, Eagle River, and Girdwood
mm-hmm.
that are all part of the municipality of Anchorage, essentially. And they're in desperate need of funding. Mm-hmm. One of the problems is that the cemetery in Anchorage is filling up. And probably somewhere like 8 to 10 years, will be full. And this is for people who just don't necessarily are part of a group that already own extra spots, right? So, our community owns an area of it.
So you're talking about mostly the Memorial Cemetery downtown Anchorage, but not necessarily the one, like, down on Clatt Road that's, like, privately owned?
Yeah, exactly right. So if you're a person that's not necessarily affiliated with any kind of group that has a cemetery plot mm-hmm. and you want to bury your loved one, mm-hmm. you have to kind of use the common area in the Anchorage Memorial Park.
Yeah.
That's the only place you can really go locally.
Gotcha.
So that being said, we're recognizing that that cemetery will fill up one day.
Girdwood and Eagle River both have municipal cemeteries as well. Mm-hmm. That are not nearly ready, prepared for the load that Anchorage Memorial Park gets. Essentially.
Oh, so if Anchorage Memorial shuts down, fills up, we'll have to start sending people out there.
Diversifying,
and then they're not ready to handle that much influx.
I don't think so. Okay. I mean, and so that's sort of the issue there.
Yeah.
And cemeteries, like any other, I would say, communal good, mm-hmm. needs funding.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not receiving enough at the moment. Yeah. And so Proposition 7, which was essentially put in there, I mean, it was a bipartisan support for it to be on the ballot,
mm-hmm.
Was there to sort of say, to ask for a bond in order to help increase funding for Anchorage's municipality cemeteries.
Right. Okay. And it failed.
It failed.
Meaning that the majority of people voted against it, and now you're hoping to revisit that vote.
I don't know. That's the goal. Like, okay. I would like to revisit it. I think one of the reasons why it failed wasn't because it was unpopular, because just no one knew about it, or
I didn't know about it until I read it on the ballot.
Right. That's problematic, right?
Yeah.
So,
which is rare for me, because usually I'm really well up on these things, but I had a funny springtime, and so I was like...
and I didn't fully understand that there wasn't really a campaign for it. I assumed there was one. I assumed a lot of things were going on that weren't going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of want to revisit this for our city. And a future date,
uh-huh.
maybe not right away, but at one point I would like to get this back on the ballot, and I would like to sort of inform everyone that's on the ballot and try to convince people why it's important, right? Because like at one point or another, you have to figure out where a loved one who passes away goes. Mm-hmm. That is just the nature of living.
So here is where we can have some hopefully enjoyable and healthy disagreement.
Yeah.
Because I look at it so differently, and I in no way am speaking for all Christians.
Sure.
Nor the traditional Christian point of view, probably. But I don't like cemeteries at all.
Really?
I can't imagine a less joyful place to spend my life than in a grid, to spend my afterlife than in a grid of buried boxes. Uh-huh. You know, it makes me think of that song, Little Boxes on the Hillside, and they're all made out of ticky tacky. Like, bury me, please, in a playground.
Oh, God.
You know, or a human dog or a dog park. Absolutely. Yeah. And again, not even human remains. First of all, cut out all my organs, put them where they're going to do good for a living person, and then cremate the rest, because I'm all done living here. You know, you can take the body and do that old John Prine song, "Don't Bury Me, Just Use Pass Me All Around."
Yeah.
And then the rest of it, cremate me. And they have all these eco-friendly ways of putting the ashes in a tree bundle, so you're just growing into something else. And then, you know, let some kids climb that tree, cut it down, and build a house for people to actually live in.
Yeah.
But in terms of using up acres and acres of real estate in a city where we have a housing crisis, and the idea of creating this antiseptic atmosphere of just flat ground with stones that you can't walk anywhere, you can't use it as space for life. And you look back a few generations and people would go to picnics, right, and celebrate and have community parks where the cemetery was. And I think we need to reclaim some of that. I would love to design a playground. I mean, a cemetery that is a playground, literally. And maybe more like a columbarium, where there's like a little insert of a stone, you know, and it's got a plaque with my name on it, but it's right alongside the swing set, and there's joy and laughter there. But yeah, I have never, ever been to the cemetery where my dad's headstone is. Not once. But we have a little spot in our backyard at home, and I remember him there. Because why look for death?
This sounds personal, Matt.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you, a lot of my work life is surrounding death and being immersed in death and going to cemeteries. I've done so many burials. I've done so many funerals.
Have you ever been to a cemetery without burying someone before?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And I don't care for it. If I want to go remember my dad, I do it at a baseball diamond.
Do you know that what we do? Once a year, we go to our plot and mm-hmm. clean every single gravestone.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a tradition in Judaism where you put a rock, instead of flowers, we put a rock on the gravestone.
Mm-hmm.
And so we re-rock them, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
And then we talk about every single person interred mm-hmm. in our cemetery to the community who's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredibly powerful experience
sure.
that our kids are encouraged to come to, mm-hmm. so that they have positive experiences at a cemetery.
And I think that's fine. And I would never want to say, hey, you Jews do it different.
I think you missed out on some positive cemetery experiences.
Maybe, but I've had a lot of positive death experiences. Mm-hmm. I don't think the cemetery is required for positive remembrance and positive positive death.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, like in Judaism, we always just say when we think about a loved one passed away, may their memory be a blessing.
Yeah.
Right? We're not thinking about the cemetery, we're thinking about, hey, the memory is a blessing. But in Judaism, like, we need cemeteries. They're a fact of life. Mm-hmm. And if you go to any cemetery, you're going to see how, like, whole swaths of different demographics mm-hmm. also need cemeteries. Mm-hmm. And one way this is a lot of people have in common is where they want to go, when they die.
Well, yeah, but that's one of those things where is that what people say because that's what people have said. Right. And if mm-hmm. we were to say, you know, due to the fact that we are just running out of space because we keep getting new dead people every single year.
Yeah.
We're just going to run out of room eventually. We need to shift it. And so that's, again, columbariums, I think, make a whole lot of sense. You can have the same sort of space for remembrance, but take up a fraction of the space. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense to me. It's probably less expensive to maintain as well. And you can still read every single name, you know?
Sure.
A place like the Vietnam Memorial Wall, where there's a walking experience, even though it's not necessarily park-like or joyful, but it's still something that's a bit more than everyone is separated out in their own little, you know, this is my room, stay out of my room for my dead person. You know, you go to yours next over there. It feels very, I don't know, I feel like we've missed a lot of what there could be, a lot of the community. And perhaps internally you have that within the Jewish community, that thing. But I still also don't see that it's sustainable. I have a lot of overlapping feelings with cemeteries and golf courses. And I think George Carlin pointed that out first, that both of them are such a disproportionate use of real estate at a time when real estate is leaving people. I mean, the people that died outdoors that we did that vigil for, we could very well build a bunch of houses on the cemetery space and say it's a space now for life and not death.
I just think a cemetery taps into a human condition mm-hmm. That it's not a waste of real estate mm-hmm. To have a place of remembrance. And that, like, certainly cemeteries take up a lot of space. You have a great point there. I see the future of cemeteries being interesting in that, you know, burying cremains, for example, takes up a lot of space than burying an actual body.
Yeah.
And the reality, too, is that, you know, in Jewish burials, you're always stepping away where the body and the casket will break down into mm-hmm. Into the ground.
Right.
And so essentially what you have is just a headstone at the end after a couple of years.
Yeah.
Anyways, so, like, you know, there's that problem, too. Yeah, I mean, I see your point, but, like, you got to be careful. I mean, a cemetery taps into something deep for people mm-hmm. And has an incredible...
If you've seen the movie Poltergeist, you know that's true.
Right, yes. They just moved the headstones, not the actual graves in Poltergeist. What a mistake that was.
That's an amateur
yeah,
mistake.
Yeah, and so that's... But that's sort of... I think there's a deep need for this. And, like, when it comes to, like, you know, planning, like, and then planning for where you're going to go when you die, like, you know... Most people think about cemeteries. Maybe they don't choose cemeteries as the final place to go, but cemeteries is definitely on the list.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, but I also think a lot of that is probably based on an era when we lived in hamlets together with generations of our family. You know, but like I said, when my dad passed away, he's got a headstone in upstate New York that I'm there once a decade. You know, mm-hmm. Sorry, Mom, it's just a long way off. You know, and so. And so does that do me any good? Not really. But I've got my dad's hat hanging next to my art table. And that's more of a place of remembrance for him than a gravesite ever could be.
Yeah.
And if I were to ever want to tell my kids, you know, this is your grandfather's life or other loved ones that we've had that have passed away, taking them to a place where we buried their remains, to me, is an unnecessary journey in terms of saying, well, this is what their life was about.
I just think it is necessary because of the vibe, right? Like, you know.
I don't mean to laugh at the idea, but describing it, you know, the cemetery vibe.
The vibe. Yeah, the cemetery vibe.
Everyone's all about everyone's the cemetery the vibe.
Yeah, everyone loves the vibe. But I feel like, you know, your dad's hat is hanging somewhere and the area around it is a room, I imagine. It has lots of other things going on.
Yeah.
Right? You know, a cemetery is one thing going on. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps people get into the mode of remembrance. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've seen it myself, and I've been part of it myself, where you go to a cemetery and you see people, like, the meaning to search turns right on. The feelings become very real. Mm-hmm. You know, people feel more vulnerable, have a capacity to understand more of their feelings at a specific place designed to remember those you've lost.
I have seen that in people. I've seen the exact opposite also, particularly as we see more and more people leaving faith communities in general across the board. They have the same sense in a cemetery that they have in a church or in a hospital, where they walk in and they think, I don't know if I belong here. I think I should get out of here.
Sure.
Right? And so I think what you're describing is as much a function of culture and habit as it is anything else. And I think for a lot of people that were not raised in that culture or in that habit, a cemetery is seen as vestigial.
Yeah. And I just, you know, I think I feel sorry that's how they're experiencing it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a faith community, like, we take care of people when they're born, and we take care of them when they die, mm-hmm. you know? And so one of the things that I get to say is that if you're a member of my community, rest assured that if you pass away, you're taken care of,
mm-hmm.
And that we have a system in place just for you. And people get a lot of, I think, closure and a lot of meaning, a lot of relief from that we offer that. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the services of a faith community.
I just did a funeral, about 2 weeks ago for a family I did not know, but the request of the deceased and that family honored this. He was a huge fan of NASA and space exploration and space sciences, and he's cremated and his ashes are compressed and launched up into permanent orbit.
Gosh.
And I love that 1,000 times more than a cemetery, not only because it's just cool, but also because you can track it. Like, you'll know the course of that orbit, and no matter where you live on the planet, you can visit them just by looking up. And, you know, permanent orbit is only like what, 50 miles away from you at any given point, whereas the cemetery right now could be 1,000 miles away from you, but you're only 50 miles away no matter where you are on Earth from your loved one's orbit of grave. And so I think that's I think that is a beautiful way to go.
Really? Your loved Absolutely, one always 100%. Up there judging you for all the choices you make?
What makes you think they're judging? First of all, they're 100% dead.
It doesn't change anything about them judging you.
And second of all, if they were judging you, it's not from their compressed ashes. It's from their spirit, which is God knows where, right? The body is gone and pointless and meaningless at that point, honestly.
I would rather have a gravestone I don't go to than have a loved one
circling
around looking over me and saying, you're not doing it right.
How is one any more practical than the other?
And
how do you know they're not judging you from inside the grave? Or do you just like can run away?
Exactly, they definitely are. So you're just not nearby.
This is sort of you getting your last laugh. You can show up at the grave and say, can't catch me.
Exactly right.
But if they have a chance of catching up to you, then...
That's scary. I don't like that at all. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah, we're gonna have to agree to disagree on this one.
Yeah.
I am, and in fact, I think this will be the first ever "What Divines Us" listener call-in poll or online poll. Tell us who's right.
We don't have any online presence, Matt. How are you even gonna do it?
Send us a self-addressed stamped envelope and tell us if you think I'm right or if stupid dummy Abram is right.
Yes, yeah. Well, come if you're a listener and you see us somewhere in the street, come up to us and tell us what you think.
That's
we need to hear you.
Just what you and I need is more random people coming up on the street telling us their opinions, right?
Yeah, exactly right. We definitely need more of that. That sounds great.
Oh, boy. All right, so we managed to turn a cemetery into a laughing matter. Good.
Go clergy.
Yeah, so that went so well. The only next reasonable step is the Middle East.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go there.
Let's make that fun and enjoyable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So it's, what's today's date? April 19th, 2024.
Yeah.
And so that'll help you if someone listens to this.
It's actually the 18th, just FYI. Who cares?
I tend to be a day ahead. Yeah, it's the 18th. Yeah. If someone listens to this in a week, for all we know, 10 really important things have happened between now and then.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? Things go fast, and there are big events taking place following, I guess, I mean, you can trace the events back 100 years, but really they started this past fall with the Hamas attack in Israel and kidnapping of many, many people.
Yeah.
Then Israel's counterattack.
Yeah.
And recently now Iran has gotten involved in ways that I've not even kept up with yet, just because I've been having to read a ton of other stuff for work, and so I've set that aside. And I guess I feel dumb asking it this way, but just very vaguely, how are you and how's your community?
I don't ever feel dumb about asking questions as complicated as, you know, conflict in the Middle East. So, I mean, we're doing, right? You know, there's a lot of things to unpack when it comes to this conflict. I think the first thing to unpack is that for us, this conflict is a cycle,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I think for a lot of younger people, this is like the first time they've experienced sort of like the conflict of essentially, we call it the Middle East, but specifically the conflict of Israel and I would say Arab neighbors. This is just the most recent iteration is what we're experiencing. And so that's one thing to think about. The other thing is that, like, us Jews, we have a lot of what's called generational trauma. Have you heard that term before?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you haven't, so generational trauma is when trauma is passed down from parents to children or from grandparents to children,
mm-hmm.
like, generation after generation after generation. And I don't like it. It's not necessarily helpful or useful, but, you know, us Jews, we've been kicked out of a lot of countries.
Mm-hmm.
We've been killed in a lot of places. And that tends to affect an entire population. And so when we see things like essentially what's called a pogrom, which is an act of killing Jews by nationality or people.
Mm-hmm.
And we see when, like, televised live on, you know, when Hamas attacked Israelis, essentially, our generational trauma gets so triggered,
mm-hmm.
right? We think, oh my God, I'm only here. And personally, I'm only here because of the pogroms that happened in Lithuania, right? And so my mm-hmm. Jewish ancestors are like, we gotta get out of here, and then immigrated essentially to the U.S. And those are my ancestors, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I know this can happen,
mm-hmm.
and I'm always wondering, can this happen again?
Right.
Because they were in a stable situation back then until it wasn't stable, right? German Jews in 1920 were stable.
Right.
1943, we're not, right? So at one point, any place that seems like a good place for Jews can not be a good place for Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And this is traumatic.
Yeah.
And this trauma gets sent down from one family to another. I honestly believe just by telling my kids that people hate Jews, I've like, continue that generational trauma, but you just can't help it.
You have to
you have to warn them.
Yeah.
So the act of warning your own children is one of the reasons why they have the trauma in the first place.
You know, my wife Elizabeth knows far more about generational trauma than I do. She studied it really in depth. But isn't there also indications that it's passed down genetically? It's not just by what you say or
yeah.
your behavior. It's not just behavioral. It's also, I think it has some impact. It can be passed down without those lessons being verbally taught.
I mean, I
might be wrong.
I can only imagine. I don't really know anything about genetics and when it comes to generational trauma. I just know that we experience it deeply.
Yeah.
And it gets triggered pretty easily for us.
Sure.
And so it's really hard not to pass it down, because mm-hmm. a lot of times the act of warning a loved one about this is you're doing it. You're creating trauma in the process. And be even acknowledging that you have it, which, you know, I do. It's really hard to intellectually say it's okay. Like, things here are safe and secure.
Right.
Intellectually, emotionally, I'm a wreck.
Because you know it can happen.
Yeah, because I know it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of, that's a lot of what I would say, not just our Jewish community, but every Jewish community in the world is experiencing right now. And everyone, no matter who you are, you manage fear, you deal with trauma differently.
Mm-hmm.
There is no one way that we all manage trauma. We all are unique individuals, mm-hmm. and we all have our own way of dealing with it.
Yeah.
So you think about that. So that means every Jewish community is, you know, within those communities are having their own ways of sort of like combating themselves or the trauma.
Yeah.
And it looks different.
Right.
And so you know, I always joke, or it's not my joke, but there's a joke, two Jews, three opinions. We mentioned that before in this podcast.
Yeah.
That's the case here. That's the case as well with trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got trauma, multiple people who deal with it differently. And so, you know, that's kind of what the Jewish community looks like at the moment. It's kind of a snapshot of what I'd say world Jewry is at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's something that we're all trying to manage.
Sure. Sure. One thing in particular I want to ask you about, and it's probably multi-part. I mean, none of this is simple, so everything we say is going to spin off in a lot of directions. But I was curious to hear the phrase ceasefire used in a way that – how do I phrase this? I felt like it meant one thing, but I think to Jewish ears it may have sounded like a different thing. So when you hear someone calling for a ceasefire, which I think came through our assembly even –
oh my gosh.
Maybe not. Maybe
talk about that?
Maybe I don't know because I'm not educated on that motion either. But in terms of just the phrase ceasefire, when I say it, it means something. But I'm wondering if it's the same as what it means for you. So when you hear ceasefire within your context of Congregation Beth Shalom here, what do you hear?
Boy, I'm not even sure where to start. Let's talk about what happened in our Anchorage Assembly.
Yeah, frame it whatever way makes sense for
you. Yeah. So okay, listeners, if you're not from Anchorage, or maybe you just didn't understand, maybe you are, you haven't heard of this yet. So our assembly, which is our city council, we've got 12 members, there was a resolution for them to pass called a ceasefire resolution, a resolution to say that the assembly supports a ceasefire, right? This sounds pretty, I would say, benign, if you just think of it like that.
Yeah.
Right. But as soon as you unpack it, it gets to be really heavy and really dark quick. So let's talk about the first thing to talk about is this. Anti-Semitism has increased over 300% since October 2023.
Mm-hmm.
That means the very conversation and the very act of Hamas attacking Israel and Israel responding to that attack as well has literally increased hate towards Jews here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that the hate is coming from people who are pro-Palestinian. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there are people who just happen to hate Jews and they feel enabled to hate them more vocally and more in the public places due to the fact that Hamas attacked Israel. There's not very logical connection there.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, hate towards the people that hasn't done you anything wrong is not terribly logical.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So when the assembly had this resolution, I told them, many Slim members, I was like, the act of you putting this up for discussion and the act of you letting possibly the public speak on this will increase anti-Semitism in this city, guaranteed. That this will harm Jews, guaranteed. Just because when we this topic itself is dangerous for us Jews.
Hmm. Okay.
You have questions? You look like you look a little confused.
Well, that's just what my face is like.
Okay. Yes. Oh,
yeah, but yeah, I do. And yeah, they're kind of all over the place. And it's one of those conversations. Like if you remember the show Seinfeld, there was one episode they were talking about homosexuality and they were trying to like ask questions about it or say things about it. And once in a while, George and Jerry would look at each other and say, I don't think we're allowed to talk about this.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm kind of having a little sense of that as in some ways, well, A, as your friend, B, as someone who likes interfaith dialogue. And I forget there was a C, but I lost it. So I want to just ask for your grace in the event that I say something offensive.
Oh, don't worry about it. Yeah.
But here was as a Christian witnessing a conflict between Jews and Muslims, I feel like, well, I'm sitting on the bleachers, you know, I'm back out of the way. And so is my main job to shut up?
Let me dissuade you from that. This is not a conflict against Jews and Muslims, right? Us Jews and Muslims are tight, especially here in Anchorage, right? This is a conflict of at the moment of a group of people, essentially, I would say a terrorist government, Hamas, against Israel.
Right.
Not all Palestinians are Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And even ethically, I wouldn't say Palestinians are necessarily completely Arab either, right? They are an ethnic group, essentially. And so...
And by that same token, as the token Jew on Christians for Equality.
Yeah, yeah.
But that same process also separating out the actions of the Israeli government from the Jewish people worldwide.
Yes.
And when I hear a comment that says supporting a ceasefire is anti-Semitic, I think, well, no, because, and again, just to be clear, I hear ceasefire and I say yes. Please.
Yeah.
When I say ceasefire, regardless of how it lands on other people's ears, when I say ceasefire, what I am saying is protect Palestinian people who are being murdered, right? Who are just being outright slaughtered in horrifying numbers.
Yeah.
Some of them little children, but age really doesn't matter. They're God's beloved children being killed, and that should stop. So that's what I'm saying when I'm saying ceasefire. And if the phrase ceasefire carries with it anti-Semitic connotations, can we come up with another word that means what I just said, that we can say, so that we can express my quasi-pacifism in a way that's not saying that we devalue Jewish lives at all. It doesn't mean I'm devaluing Jewish lives to lift up Palestinian lives.
Well, let me continue the story with the assembly, and maybe some of that will come clear to you.
Okay.
All right. So explain to the assembly, here's the problem with having this conversation specifically with opening it up to the public.
Yeah.
Right. That you're going to get a lot of crazies who are going to come in and they're going to say,
because as we all know, the public is stupid.
I don't necessarily agree with that, but okay.
And if you don't recognize our voices, it was Abram that said that.
No. I was like, we gotta be careful, and we gotta be mindful about how you have this conversation.
Yeah.
If you're not careful and mindful, it'll get crazy fast.
Right.
I know assembly members, I was telling them, I know you may not fully understand this process, but to take it from someone who's Jewish, things get bad fast when it comes to anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And so please be respectful of our community when you have this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally I said, and I would prefer that you wouldn't have this conversation at all, that I don't think this is an appropriate place to have this conversation. I'm not trying to stop the conversation from happening. I just don't think it should happen at an assembly meeting. I think there should be another venue for it, like what to do about this term ceasefire, for example.
Okay.
Now, I convinced 9 assembly members of that.
Okay.
But however, for a resolution to be on the agenda, it only needs 3 sponsors.
Yeah,
and so of the 12, I convinced 9. I did not convince the other 3, and
right.
They sponsored it, and so it became an agenda on, for their meeting. So the next step was like, okay, I talked to the 3, and I was like, understand what's happening here, and I was like, can we just shut this down, and can we move this conversation over somewhere else? Let me explain to you why this is problematic. I explained to them kind of what I just told you just a moment ago.
Yeah,
and I also explained one other component of this is that the reality is that it's their schools. It's our Jewish kids that deal with anti-Semitism a lot of times more often than grown-ups do,
mm-hmm.
right? Because schools are incubators, and kids are always trying things out. And there's not always a lot of adult supervision at schools. And so I'm really honestly what I'm trying to do is protect Jewish children mm-hmm. when I say to the assembly members, we can have a conversation about ceasefire, but let's have it in a different venue. We can control more variables. And I couldn't convince them. I couldn't convince them to drop it. And so they're like, we're going to keep talking about this. This is important. So the next problem was this. The actual language of the ceasefire resolution did not mention Hamas once.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was a very, I would say, antiseptic, like, version of, like, we just want the killing to stop. Kind of like what you said earlier, Matt. But the problem with that is that there is a Jewish narrative here that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And this ceasefire resolution was not addressing it.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean when you say there's a Jewish narrative that needs to be addressed.
Israel is trying to protect itself.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And how Israel does it is up for debate. How much any Jew likes it is up for debate. But Israel needs to exist. That's not up for debate.
Mm-hmm.
And this ceasefire didn't address any of that. It just said there should be peace. That's all it said.
So you're not against the idea of a proclamation of some sort.
No,
you just felt like it wasn't careful.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And to their credit, like, the people, the three individuals who didn't want, who co-signed this resolution and co-sponsored it and wanted to keep it going, they heard us in some ways. And so they did not open the conversation up to the public, luckily. And they kept the conversation less than an hour, luckily.
Yeah.
And so, but the weird thing was that we were like, you can't, if you want to offer a ceasefire resolution, this is every war is messy, and you can't ignore the mess. You can't just say we want peace on Earth, ceasefire now. You have to embrace the mess because it is messy, and it's not fair to us Jews who have to deal with this every day. In some form or another, this war affects Jews in Alaska profoundly almost every day. Mm-hmm. We're so far away from the conflict, and yet we're thinking about it all the time. So if you want to create a resolution that deeply affects our community, you at least need to line up the resolution correctly so that we feel like it lines up with the reality on the ground.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And so they did. They ended up changing the language of the resolution like last minute.
Like
literally last minute.
What was it changed to?
To say that, like, you know, part of this, part of the reason why there is no peace is because Hamas attacked Israel first. Now Israel is trying to defend itself. The level of it was defending itself is up to debate, like I mentioned before. And I'll go into that a little bit more later.
Okay.
But like, it's still like this. It's messy. Like, it's a messy conflict, and it did embrace the mess. And at the end of the day, it got passed. And then what did that do? Like, passing that resolution, what did that solve the crisis, the war,
well,
the Hamas-Israel war?
I doubt it, but I also wonder if it's similar to what you've said frequently about counter speech being very important.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
And if we see something unjust taking place, it matters that we speak about it, whether it's speaking as an individual or as a faith community or as a city.
Yeah.
And I think I'll speak only for myself, but I think many people would agree that the current actions by the country of Israel are beyond what they should be by a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that the ceasefire resolution was claiming, but it was not claiming that Hamas started it at first.
Okay.
Right. That's not right. That's not part of the actual reality on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't line up with what's real.
Mm-hmm.
It was very one-sided.
Oh, sure. But when you say, did it accomplish something? I would say that perhaps what it accomplished was the same thing that counter speech accomplishes ever, which is to say there is an injustice taking place. So the updated version that you said you felt was a bit more accurate, right, and a bit more balanced, to speak up and say the current strategy is doing damage in too extraordinary of a way. And that shouldn't continue.
Okay.
I think that as a form of formalized counter speech,
I guess
it doesn't fix the problem, but at least it doesn't ignore it either.
But why this conflict, Matt? Has there been a ceasefire resolution for any other conflict in the world that other assembly has passed?
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if there were some.
There's been exactly one more.
Okay.
And it's been Ukraine and Russia.
Okay.
But isn't there more conflict going on in this world than what's happening in Israel versus Palestinians and Ukraine and Russia?
Well, the Ukraine and Russia one, I supported too.
Sure, but there's a lot more conflict happening, mm-hmm. right? I mean, look at the Syria refugee crisis, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many. I mean, look at the many crises occurring in Africa, right? It feels a bit focused. When you say, I want to create a resolution that asks for peace on Earth, and you focus on Israel and Hamas, mm-hmm. and you don't focus on anything else, that feels targeted.
Yeah, sure. But they did focus on something else. They also focused on Ukraine and Russia. And I think one
not
thing
in this resolution, though.
Oh, right? No, but they've done it before.
Yeah,
and so I think what both of those things have in common are, A, we're divided as a country right now when we feel like we say a lot about everything. But also, B, I think a lot of people have this sense of, is this, you know, one of those triggering things that pulls the whole world into it?
Yeah.
I think both of those conflicts have that sense of, oh boy, is this that part of the roller coaster right before that first drop, and we're all going to get pulled into this global conflict. And so in that regard, it makes a lot more sense than, you know, East Borneo versus West Borneo having a fight within themselves. It's like, well, that's not going to impact us really, but this one really potentially could.
I don't really see how the specific one could actually impact us. Other than that, it makes the news all the time.
I think everything in the Middle East impacts us. I mean, not only because of oil, but also because of religion that has its tendrils into our three major religions in this country.
Sure.
So we're all tied to it in some way, shape, or form.
And it's not the only conflict happening in the Middle East. right? So I just, when us Jews feel targeted, we feel like there's a heightened sense of like conversation and language around this specific conflict. There hasn't been a heightened sense of conflict and language around other conflicts.
I think it's fair to say, though, that in my lifetime, I've never seen Israel behave in this extraordinary of a manner. And so while the Middle East tensions between Israel and Palestine have always been a headline, right, repeating throughout, I've never in my lifetime seen the word genocide used for it, right?
Sure.
And what I see happening is that word frequently being used at the high levels of our government. And I think there's a point. I think that there's a real point to be made that that is what we're witnessing. And so I think that does up the importance of counter speech.
Sure. And then I don't feel the same way you do, Matt, about this.
Yeah.
And like and to be frank and to be fair, like, I don't like how the Israel government is responding to this.
Yeah.
I like the Israel government for the Hamas attack, right? It's the farthest
right
Israel like government that Israel's ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And Bibi Netanyahu, the current prime minister, is essentially been a convicted criminal, right? And I don't think has any right to lead the country. I mean, obviously, I'm American, so what do I say matters, which he has pointed out numerous times already. to the U.S. I disagree with the U.S. government, with the Israel government,
yeah.
And I certainly disagree with the way they've chosen to respond to the Hamas attack. Absolutely. To a majority of Jews, by the way.
So, and again, I'm trying my best to understand your perspective then, which is, even though you disagreed with the Anchorage Assembly's involvement, you disagree with the Israeli government's actions at the moment, too.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right.
That helps me to understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. But not everyone understands this argument as nuanced as we're describing it right now, Matt.
This conversation here is probably 100 times longer than most people have on the topic, right?
Yeah,
they say pro, no, con, and then that's the end of it.
Right.
Yeah.
So I have to be very careful, Matt.
Of course.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, with you and internally with this community, we're very nuanced about how we feel about this conversation.
Do you have differing opinions within Congregation Beth Shalom on the whole thing?
So many.
I kind of asked that knowing the answer is yes, but yeah.
Every single opinion you can think of happened under the roof of Congregation Beth Shalom. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's one component of this too. But the reality is that I have to be so careful when I'm talking to essentially the rest of the Anchorage or Alaska or world community when it comes to talking with this issue.
Yeah.
So careful, because I can't be as nuanced when talking to a greater population about this.
And I guess I can understand. I agree with you. And I'm just trying again from what I feel like is a spot in the bleachers. I can understand why when Hamas attacked last fall, the response was so visceral to say, we have to go get these hostages.
Right? Yeah,
it's just, what are you talking about nuance and votes for? Go get these people's lives.
Yeah, yeah.
And that visceral feeling, we were talking before about the importance of feelings, that visceral feeling is so legitimate, right?
Yeah.
And I think that visceral, legitimate feeling is what every single Palestinian mother is feeling right now, saying, cease fire, let me get my babies a glass of water.
Let's talk about ceasefire for a moment.
Yeah.
Yes, I think every Jewish person can say they want the war to end.
Mm-hmm.
They want a ceasefire.
Yeah.
But there is a prominent sort of ceasefire movement happening specifically in the U.S. and more importantly on college campuses that is very much directed towards Israel and feels inauthentic.
Hmm.
And the reason why it feels inauthentic was brought out when Iran attacked Israel this last week. So for the listeners who don't know, Iran retaliated against Israel. Israel ended up attacking a Iranian embassy in, I believe, Syria, and ended up killing a really important general, an Iranian general. So Iran retaliated for the first time historically by physically attacking Israel's borders with missiles and drones.
And did Israel have a stated reason for why they did that?
Yeah, this specific general works with a lot of Iranian proxies to attack Israel.
Okay.
So Israel claims they're defending themselves. Now, the U.S. did not like that at all. Okay. Israel did that at all, by the way. The U.S. stance was like, we didn't know this was going to happen. You know, we don't really support this. But Israel said, well, we have a right to protect our sovereignty. This guy has been doing a lot of damage to us. We had an opportunity to take him out. We did.
Yeah.
And so Iran retaliated by sending drones and missiles over to, you know, essentially towards Israel. Iran has attacked Israel through proxies, but mm-hmm. never directly before.
Right.
This is the first time this has happened.
And I think that sense of unprecedented.
Yeah.
Sorry to circle back, but you mentioned before about the assembly. Why now? Why is this one being talked about? I think there's so much about what's going on now that feels unprecedented, at least in our lifetime.
Yeah.
Right.
Let me finish this.
Sure.
So when this happened, a number, not all of them, of course, but mm-hmm. a number of pro-Palestinian groups asking for a ceasefire celebrated Iran's attack on Israel.
Yeah, well, that's shitty. Yeah.
But that's why it feels inauthentic, mm-hmm. right? That these pro-Palestinian groups are saying we need a ceasefire, right? Because there shouldn't be any war because people are dying. And then when Iran attacks Israel, escalating the war, mm-hmm. they celebrate it. So that's part of the problem is that obviously this is not all people who are part of the pro-style.
Right.
Right. That's, obviously. Yeah. Right.
The idea of a ceasefire a bad idea.
Yeah,
it just makes them people who made a real shitty choice at that time.
But then who do I communicate on the pro-Palestinian side to say, hey, like, I don't necessarily disagree with you, mm-hmm. but are you part of these guys? I don't know. I don't, you know, like, what is your specific platform here?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then, of course, like, you know, you hear pro-Palestinians say, you know, free Palestine. And I'm always like, but what does that mean specifically?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do you want all 7 to 8 million Jews who live in Israel just to leave?
I don't think that's what they're saying, A. And B, I think it's less saying, hey, everyone, I have the plan for what's going to work, and more saying what's currently going on is not working.
Agree. But when you say free Palestine, it's so ambiguous.
Well, for the record, I don't say that because I'm not one for slogans either.
Sure,
but
sure.
I will say something like, the current structure is not working, and it's causing misery and death and horror all around the world, really, but in particular right there. And so I don't think you always have to say, I have the answer for the better way forward, to simply say, I recognize a current injustice. And I think that's how a lot of people are feeling about this ceasefire, too. Even another aspect of the ceasefire being, a lot of people are saying temporary. You know, give us a ceasefire for X number of days for the aid workers to come in without being bombed while they're delivering food, and then get some safety to some people. Then if war continues to happen, war obviously is a horrible thing, but it's with us throughout history. If the war continues, at least give us a chance to put a little sprinkling of compassion into that mix to let water get to the hospital or something like that.
The other complicated issue is Hamas, mm-hmm. Matt. Like, a ceasefire requires a cessation of fire from two different sides, right? Mm-hmm. And Israel has been, rightfully, you saying they have been bombing this area, and I don't agree with that at all. But they're also trying to negotiate with Hamas, and Hamas is not being necessarily negotiating with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what is Israel to do? I mean, obviously we can't second guess the nation and their sovereignty. And we can definitely agree what they're doing now isn't, I don't think, the right choice. But,
right. Yeah.
But like, how are, like, if they're working, if they're trying to negotiate with a party that isn't necessarily willing to negotiate, or maybe even can negotiate, I don't really know, mm-hmm. then how, what does the ceasefire look like? It's a very, the whole thing is very, like, non-linear.
Yeah.
The whole thing is asymmetrical.
Well, as you said before, though, conflicts like this are always messy, right?
Yes.
And so at the moment, perhaps it's going to be choosing mess A or mess B. And if mess A is continuing as we're going with the results of, I don't know the current number of how many thousands of civilian lives lost in Palestine.
So over 30,000, which is unbelievable.
Or trying mess B, which is 1 week worth of ceasefire to get aid to where it's going and see what that does, then absolutely mess B.
Right. And like
try the different thing where we're not bombing children.
I like mess B too.
Yeah.
Obviously, I have no control over Israel's choices, right. but I'm still put in their camp just by being Jewish, Matt. I mean, that's part of the problem too. I can tell tons of people who are not Jewish, I don't support what Israel is doing, and they may hear me as, I don't support Israel existing. And this is where I have to be so careful.
Yeah, definitely you and I are in different contexts in terms of how careful they have to be, because A, I have the option to say, I'm not speaking for all Christians here, and then I can run my mouth, whereas you're a rabbi, and whatever you say is going to be scrutinized.
Yeah, exactly. So externally, I'm like, Israel needs to exist, you know, and I may not even say I disagree with the government, even though personally I very much do, because I'm, as someone who's Jewish, I need Israel to exist.
When you say that, I agree, and I look at the Jewish people as a minority people that have the right to exist and their nation has the right to exist. But again, from my outsider perspective, I look at Palestine and I see Palestine and the people who are Muslim and the Palestinian people as a people who have a right to exist, and they have a nation that has the right to exist and all sides the right to defend themselves. And it's not as – to me, saying that doesn't end the mess.
Oh, my gosh. Right? Of course not.
Yeah.
But I don't have a lot of options.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
And so I – if someone says, because you say that Israel has a right to exist, that makes you supporting genocide – you know, which, by the way, has happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say, I don't know how to tell you. Like, I don't support genocide, right. obviously, you know.
What I meant to say was like a domino effect where they say, if you said phrase A, that means you believe phrase B, right? It's terrible, isn't it? Like you say one thing that seems like it's something you truly believe, and they say, well, therefore, you believe this whole long chain of events that follow. And you're like, no, not necessarily. No, right. I believe the one thing I said.
But that's the box I get put into.
Yeah.
And to get out of that box is, when it comes to working with a bunch of people who are not Jewish, is almost impossible.
Of course.
Yeah. And so I've made my choice about how I'm going to manage this for my community and for myself. And that is, I believe Israel should exist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I believe it should, too. But when I – thinking back on my own Christian faith, and one of the guiding parables that Jesus spoke was he put the sheep on one side and the goats on the left. I don't know how far this story has gone outside of Christianity. But – and he says to the sheep, come on into heaven, because when you saw me hungry, you gave me food. And when you saw me thirsty, you gave me water. And you goats, when you saw me hungry, you didn't. And when you saw me thirsty, you didn't. And they said, when did we ever even see you? And he says, whenever you did it for the least of the people on earth, you did it for me. And so I see Jesus among the Jews that are being held hostage by Hamas.
It's a weird statement to say, by the way.
But it's true. I appreciate the humor of it and the absurdity of it. Jesus's parables often were comical and weird and absurd. Yeah. It's funny and it's true. Jesus is one of those Jewish hostages, and Jesus is one of the murdered Palestinians killed by the Israeli government. And so from my perspective, when I say ceasefire, I'm saying you're all God's children, and the killing has to stop, at least for a brief side, to protect both groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think back frequently on the myth of redemptive violence, if you're familiar with that, where throughout history, both in our fiction, in our mythology, but also in our actual actions, we have this stupid thought that if we just are a bit more violent next time, it's going to fix the problem.
Yeah.
Right. And if we, you know, we dropped like 500,000 bombs last year. We should have dropped 500,001 bombs, and that would have fixed the problem. Right. I think Israel's current actions are creating the biggest next generation of terrorists and of insurgents and of enemy armies that has ever been created, because they're going to see the response took place here and say, we have the right to exist too, and we have to do it by violence. I think next generation, we're going to see this all just echo right back.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's, I mean, we've, yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, this is why this iteration of it is occurring because this already happened
right.
or before.
Yeah.
Right. So
and it's going to happen again.
So
and my golly, what's being sown right now?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I can't defend a thing like a country that I have no say or control over.
Yeah.
You can't even defend what America does. You know what I mean?
Right.
I can't have no control over that. So I got nothing for you, Matt.
Yeah. It's really so, it's almost impossible to talk about, let alone take action on.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And that's what every Jewish person in the world is experiencing right now, Matt.
Yeah.
Like, you know, one thing I wish Israel did was understand how much their actions harm or help world Jewry. And because, you know, it's a hell of a PR campaign to say, hey, we don't necessarily agree that what Israel's doing, but we need Israel to exist. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, how do you thread that needle?
And I'm not a PR person. I'm not paid to be Israel's PR person,
yeah.
You know, but almost every Jewish community has a deep connection with Israel one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think Israel respects that connection enough.
Okay. Yeah. I think it would be only appropriate to acknowledge that we have a Christian and a Jew talking about this with no Muslim at the table.
No Palestinian at the table.
Okay. Well, we have two Americans.
Yeah.
One Jew, one Christian, no Palestinian, no Muslim.
Yeah.
You know, both from faith or nationality, there's a voice missing here. And so I don't claim to be able to speak for anyone else other than myself. So I just think it's good to acknowledge that absence.
Sure. I me too.
All right. Well, we talked about cemeteries and funerals and war. Tune in next time for pestilence and famine. You know, next time we will have pestilence because the cicada bloom is coming to the East Coast. And it's a rare occurrence where I think the 17-year and the 10-year and the 3-year
all come at the same time.
The cycles all come at the same time. I said bloom. I think I meant brood. they all come at the same time. And I was there. I was a student at Princeton Seminary the last time it happened in the year 2003, I think it was. And it was insane. Have you ever seen a cicada?
No, never seen one.
They're about the size of a golf ball, but not as spherical, you know, and they buzz around like with the sound of a June bug or a big bumblebee, like a tiny little helicopter. Or did you see Dune?
Yeah.
Those ornithopters.
Yes, yeah.
It's like those, uh-huh. And they're the size of a golf ball and they're dopey. They kind of meander around, they bonk into you. But we would walk out, and they come out and they molt out of their shells. They leave their exoskeleton on the ground, walking across the grass. It was a carpet of them that you couldn't see the grass.
Wow.
For all of the bug exoskeletons, it crunch, 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 crunch as you walked.
That's crazy.
No one wore like sandals that summer because it was gross as heck. It is absolutely insane. I think I'm bad with math, but I'm pretty sure the number is in the billions of how many cicadas will hatch, and they're that big. It's just they're covering all the surfaces of the walls and all the trees, and they're hanging in the branches, and they make that high pitched trilling sound. So all day long you hear like throughout all the forests everywhere, deafening. You have to like raise your voice to talk to people.
Wow.
It's I say this with a theological degree behind me. It's an occurrence of biblical proportions.
Oh man, that's hilarious.
So next time we'll see if that's going to happen. Oh, that should be our Passover special.
Passover starts on Monday night, by the way.
Yeah.
So Passover is in a few days.
Oh, the cicadas are going to be a little bit late.
Yeah.
When does Passover end? How long is it?
So it depends. If you're in Israel, it's 7 days. If you're outside of Israel, it's 8 days.
Why the difference?
That's an interesting question. I'll end you by explaining this one to
okay.
you, right? So Judaism is like a religion that's old enough that's like been around since before like the internet, for example.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That old.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. But it's also been around since sort of like modern versions of mail delivery.
Okay.
Uh-huh. You know, it's also been around longer than I would say any form of messaging. Right,
okay.
And so there was a fear that if you lived outside of Israel, you'd get the days wrong. on holidays, and so you add an extra day to specific holidays just to help,
just in case. Okay.
So it was like a just in case kind of measure. So there's lots of holidays where it's less time in Israel than it is outside of Israel. Ironically, a lot of the calendar was kept in Babylon. So you know, because the Israelites were forced to like move there,
right.
and doubly ironically, they thrived there.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the math was done there, and then they would send messengers out for the and say, "Here's the things that are happening for the year."
Gotcha.
But Israel was always like the even in Babylon, there Israel was like the premier location.
Okay.
So that's why it's different days depending on whether you're in Israel or outside Israel. Just once again, a point of why every Jewish community is deeply involved in Israel.
Right. Yeah. You've got some central information flow going on there.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Cool.
All right. Well, if you've gotten this far, this is a longer episode.
How long did we go? I can't see the ticker.
We're over an hour and 11 minutes, essentially.
Oh, our sponsors are going to be so mad.
Yeah.
Sorry to all the good people at Blue Apron.
No, we're not.
Blue Apron, providing you pre-cooked meals.
No, we have to hear that first time we listen to podcasts already, man. The one advantage we have of not having sponsors, we don't have to say that.
That's true. Well, remember to vote on our website, brought to you by Squarespace.
No. Our dozen of listeners are going to be angry at us, Matt.
Alrighty. Thanks for listening, anybody. And nice talking to you, Abram.
Yes, nice talking to you, Matt. Thank you for having this conversation with me.
You too,
man. All right, y'all. Take care.
Bye.